At last, Star-Log, a serious science fiction magazine. The making of Star Wars, Close Encounters, the Superman movie. In Star-Log, the astonishing magazine of science fiction and fact.
There and welcome to Pod Stallions, the official podcast of Pod Stallions, because there's a lot of unofficial podcasts running around there. I'm Brian, and with me as always is Jason.
Good afternoon, morning, evening, whenever you choose to be listening.
It's evening here right now. It's daytime there for you, right?
It's afternoonish.
Okay. So the topic of this week's episode, or this month's episode, is one that's definitely Jason and I feel very strongly on. And I got to be honest with you, there wouldn't be this podcast without Star-Log magazine.
I think you're right.
Set me, first of all, and I'll get to this, but first of all, it taught me how to be a geek. It opened my windows, and it set me on the roller coaster of toy collecting, which, you know, if you're my wife, you're not such a big fan of Star-Log. There wouldn't be Plaid Stallions. There likely wouldn't be my involvement in the Mega Museum, all that stuff, and definitely this without Star-Log magazine.
I think you're right, and I've said this before to you in private. I've said it on
closed doors.
I've said it on Geek Shell and Herod. I've said it to many people. I really do think that Star-Log was the geek internet for such things.
Yeah.
Before the internet, it was where we got our information. It's where the thing, you know, big news items were broken. It's where we could go to get retrospectives. You know, it was I think following in the footsteps of fanzines, which really kicked off in the late 60s, early 70s, where fanzines were doing, you know, episode guides or retrospectives on shows that were in syndication. Well, Star-Log took that to the next level. So we learned about stuff before our time as well. But even more importantly, again, probably not for our significant others who are not fans of this particular aspect, but it really, for me, was the first place outside of a Target or a Children's Palace or Toys R Us to go to find merchandise out of the bubble, out of the norm of, you know, the places that you'd go to find such things. The cult items or the foreign items. What it also did was kind of open the door for cult merchandise and, you know, left of center titles and merchandise that you couldn't find at the local toy stores or the chains. We'll get to that aspect. So what I'm saying, this episode is really, you know, Star-Log is the umbrella, but under it, we're going to talk about other magazines and other publications that were out that really Star-Log was the gateway, I think, that made us pick up. You know, if you couldn't find Star-Log and these particular titles were on the shelf, you'd grab one of those issues to kind of tide you over.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of them felt like the way, you know, if Mad wasn't available, you bought a cracked.
Exactly.
But I think Star-Log, I think it's safe to say Star-Log was to our generation, Gen X, what Famous Monsters was to the baby boomers.
Yes.
There'd never been anything like Famous Monsters. And then Star-Log kind of took that concept. Like, I discovered Star-Log first. And then when I did find Famous Monsters, it was probably 80 or 79. I don't remember. But I remember picking it up because it had an article on space monsters like Outer Limits and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as I appreciated all the merchandise in the back, I remember as a kid even going, like, you know, the paper sucked and the weird the weird punny writing. Like, Starlog had such good, straightforward journalism that I had been spoiled on it.
Well, it's interesting, you know, when that really comes to light, and when you look back on it, and I have actually pulled out a couple of classic issues that I have hidden away upstairs.
I found one issue in my drawer, and it was the April 1982.
Okay.
And I remember buying this off the shelf because it has about a 4-page article on the Lost in Space robot.
Oh, wow.
And I was super excited to get this issue because Lost in Space was being rerun at the time. You know?
Well, that brings me to an interesting point, which you, I thought of as soon as you said famous monsters. Well, first of all, what I was going to say is you really notice just how seriously science fiction was being taken and how Starlog really was the only legitimate in the eyes of that world avenue. When you look at the anniversary issues, every year they would do an anniversary issue. So I've got one here that's the fourth anniversary issue, which is from July of 1980. And I'll tell you what's on the cover in a moment that'll make you salivate. But inside, you'd have the tributes. You'd have people saying, you know, good for, you know, Leonard Nimoy, like, congratulations, happy fourth birthday, Starlog, you know, thanks for being there, whatever. But then you'd have people like Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov and Frank Herbert, you know, these real, you know, godfathers of science fiction, writing, you know, little greetings and, you know, in Asimov's case, probably pretentious, you know, uber
diatribes.
Diatribes. But, you know, those guys went to look at Starlog for this stuff as well. But what I was going to say was what's interesting is Famous Monsters was, you know, Famous Monsters of Filmland. Then it became Famous Monsters. But it really was about monster, monster, monster. Sometimes it would delve into things, like you said, like the Twilight Zone or Outer Limits when they had, you know, creatures, and that was sort of in the sci-fi realm.
But they tried to jump on that Star Wars bandwagon.
Exactly.
And it didn't
As
take.
A rule, it stayed with monsters and creepy crawlies until Star Wars, when everything, you know, from Newsweek to Famous Monsters, when everything started to jump into science fiction, and it made that much, much broader. But let me just tell you this is the fourth anniversary issue. And for those of you that are, you know, fans of Starlog or that know what we're talking about, this was an exciting one. I mean, eventually they started doing the Starlog scrapbook, which I really loved.
I still have mine, yeah.
I don't have any of
okay,
them.
Okay, I actually have the same issue up on my screen now, so this is
you
great.
You do? Okay, yeah. Great. So this is July of 1988. It's issue number 36. And this will just tell you, when you saw this on the shelf, first off, I just want to say, we keep digressing, but I can't help it because this is what happens with memories where we come up with this stuff. The main place that I would find Starlog was B. Dalton Booksellers. Do you know B. Dalton? Did you have that?
We didn't have it, but I remember, I think, Reading Rainbow was a sponsor of.
Okay, so B. Dalton. Here's my connection to B. Dalton and a connection to Plaid Stallions. I sent you pictures many, many years ago.
Oh, yeah. You had Darth Vader, right?
Me meeting Darth Vader at B. Dalton bookstore in the Maplewood Mall. So you can, anybody wants to look at those, you can look at those. But
I'll put
B.
those Dalton in those big, show links.
B. Dalton was a big one, and Walden Books. Also, the only Doctor Who books, paperbacks I could find were the Pinnacle editions. There were 10... 10 paperbacks that were released in the U.S. under a publisher called Pinnacle. Completely different artwork on the cover, completely different logos, but and with an introduction. Each one had the same introduction, but each one had an introduction by Harlan Ellison, a typical salty, everything sucks but Doctor Who introduction by Harlan Ellison. And they're now kind of – I used to trade – you know, pen pals that I had in the UK when I was, you know, 11, 12 years old, they would hunt for those Pinnacle paperbacks. They wanted them so badly, and I would trade for the Target stuff. But that was Pinnacle, you know, when Doctor Who started to hit the US in the late 70s, Pinnacle said, let's do some books. So anyway, that's where I went to find those. So, but when I would go to the Rosedale Mall, I remember where this where B. Dalton was in the Rosedale Mall in St. Paul. And I would come around a certain corner. You know how, like, you'd go to the mall with your mom?
Yeah.
And, you know, we didn't have cell phones, so you just had a watch. And, you know, not that you minded walking around with your mom, but, you know, at 11, 12 years old, you kind of wanted to be more independent. Mm-hmm. So it'd be like, I might go to the arcade, probably hit the bookstore, maybe the toy store, whatever. But let's just, you know, let's meet back at the fountain, you know, in like an hour and a half, you know, and that's how we did it. So I'm off on my own, and I would come around a corner where B. Dalton was, and man, within just like the mailbox, when I would send away for stuff and packages showed up at the front door, I could smell a new Starlog issue from, you know, 500 feet away as you're walking towards B. Dalton, because the front of the store, the magazine rack, as you walked in, the magazine rack was to the left. And there it was, usually in the front. And it's synonymous with a Saturday, you know, visit to the mall at Rosedale and going to B. Dalton. It's just synonymous with Starlog. So when
similar with me is the mall that my grandparents had a store in. There was a hole in the wall bookstore that sold it. And I used to be able to get it there because I could con my grandmother into buying it for me.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Wait, because your folks didn't approve or something?
I don't think my grandmother was an easier touch than my folks.
Gotcha.
My folks were good for, you know, Marvel Comics, you know.
Right.
But my grandmother, you could get a magazine out of.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you saw the cover of Starlog, it was like, ooh, it's going to be a good day because there's a new issue. But when it was an anniversary issue, it was like, holy shit.
What did I do right?
Here's the cover of the July 1980 fourth anniversary issue of Starlog in no particular order. Here's the photos and the names of properties on the cover. The Empire Strikes Back, Star Trek, and it's a picture of Kirk and Spock from Motion Picture, Alien, Moonraker, The Black Hole, The Martian Chronicles, Doctor Who, with a picture of Tom Baker, Saturn III, one of the greatest science fiction films of the 70s. Kidding.
The greatest.
Buck Rogers and Mork and Mindy.
And you know, that was the beauty of Starlog, is that they would take from everything.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, originally they were just supposed to be a Star Trek magazine.
Yes, tell us all about that, Brian. I heard that as well, but tell me what that means.
Well, what that means is they were going to be a licensed publication.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and then they, from what I understand, they scrapped it because it was going to cost too much money, and then of course. I think it's Kerry O'Quinn who created Starlog, thought if I just make a science fiction magazine with, you know, and build it around Star Trek, I can avoid paying any royalties.
Ah.
And of course, that also was the point Space 1999 launched, and, you know, and a few other properties. So they just, Starlog became this kind of like equal opportunity magazine. You know?
Well, this is another good point to digress about Star Trek, which we could literally do every episode. And we tried doing an episode devoted to Star Trek. You know, we did it from its beginnings up until Wrath of Khan. We never really did a part two. But the problem is you could spend 6 hours talking about the miracle of Star Trek. And again, it's not even one of my favorite things of all time. I do love it. But what's the miracle of it is that it found the audience that it did after the fact, and that you need 100 episodes to get into syndication. Somebody somewhere convinced, you know, the whoever it is to take this show, even though it was only 79 episodes, to take it and put it into syndication. But it's remarkable how quickly after it went off the air that it built this audience that opened the door not only for it to continue in one way, shape, or form as a property, but what it did for science fiction. You know, it even led to Star Wars because of the popularity of that syndicated thing, the motion pictures, the merchandise. And now you're talking about something like this, like a magazine like this, that there was such an audience for Star Trek that it was, you know, a possibility that this magazine would have existed just devoted to Star Trek. I heard something recently too. I don't know if you and I talked about this or who I just talked about this with, was that if they were able to have tracked the demographics when the show was on the air the way they could in the early 70s.
Yeah.
Then it never would have gone off the air.
Yeah, because it was even though it wasn't big numbers, it was the core demographic. It was the hardest to get. Wasn't it like?
Yeah, it was like young, you know, men or men, you know, ages 18 to 25 or whatever it was a big part of the audience. And they said that, you know, if they were able to dig that deep, they never would have canceled it, which is amazing. So, okay. So there's an example of a great issue with all the
animals. And if you open it up, they have those beautiful collages. Remember they would do those photo collages mixing, you know, TV Spider-Man with Luke Skywalker and this was just well done, you know?
It was. And, you know, I'll admit that when I reached a certain age, I did kind of make sure I had it in a brown paper bag as I was walking around Rosedale for some reason. I felt like it was still a little taboo, and you might get made fun of for being into sci-fi.
That was the cross we had to bear.
Yes. I remember certain things that were specific to Starlog that I maybe heard, in other words, that heard the first time or rumor things that got started. I remember the very first image that I ever saw from Return of the Jedi was doing that same walk up to the magazine rack at Rosedale at B. Dalton. And the cover image was the similar, you know, they did it three times. They did it. There's that great shot of Han, Chewie, Luke, and Ben in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon from Star Wars. There's that great iconic shot of Han, Chewie, Leia, and 3PO in the cockpit of the Falcon from Empire. And then there was one that was Han, Leia, Luke. I think it's Han, Chewie, Leia, Luke, and 3PO and R2 maybe, all in the cockpit of the shuttle Tidarium for Return of the Jedi. That was the very first picture I ever saw from Jedi. It was the cover of that issue of Starlog. And not only did it sort of make my heart stop because it was like, the new Star Wars, I mean, it's really happening. It's only a couple months away. But it was the first photographic evidence that I had that Han Solo was going to be in the film, that he lived, because we didn't know what was going on. He was frozen, and that cliffhanger, we didn't know what was going to happen to Han. So that was a big deal. I also remember when they would – at the back of the – I've got two more issues here. I've got issue 41 and issue 42. I'll tell you why in a moment. Well, the issue 41 is the new Flash Gordon, interviews with Sam Flash Jones and Melody Dale Anderson, and it's got Ming on the cover, that iconic shot of Ming.
Actually, that one I remember particularly my dad chewing me out for wasting my grandmother's money on.
Jeez, Dad!
I remember that. I will never not think of that.
Wow.
When I see that cover.
Oh, that's great, though. So in the back, here's what it would be for next month. First off, in the very back page, you'd have Last Word from Howard Zimmerman, who is the editor.
Yeah, I remember him.
And then he looked like a transgender. And then on the right side, next month, Star Trek's Other Alien. No matter where Leonard Nimoy's career may take him, he'll always be identified as Mr. Spock, Star Trek's Vulcan science officer. But how many people remember the other Vulcan from the TV series, Spock's father, Sarek?
So
it's saying, oh, we're going to get Mark Leonard. Then the next one, Doctor Who's Companions. It's an interview when I think Elizabeth Sladen and Ian Martyr did like a tour, like a U.S. tour. I don't know if it was just conventions or to public television stations, but back in 79, 80, they did a U.S. tour and showed up and did loads of interviews for Doctor Who. Special insert, have a special vinyl recording, you know, a little record. But what I'm saying, so in that little section there, I remember reading once, coming up, you know, that Harrison Ford's next film is called Blade Runner, and he may have to shave his head. And I remember reading that, sort of, you know, my stomach kind of turning, because, you know, I'm 11, and I don't know why that made me scared, or I don't know that he'd shave his head, like why that bothered me. But it was such an odd thing in hindsight for them to write, because they must have been talking about the buzz cut that he had for Blade Runner, which at the time it wasn't shocking, but it was kind of It's so amazing when you look at him and you look at Blade Runner, again, digressing, but if you look at the style of Blade Runner, I think it's one of the reasons that it holds up so well and people love it as much as they do. The design, just like Star Wars, the designs for especially the first film and the second one a bit, they haven't dated a bit, considering the time frame.
Because we have big billboards of Atari logos.
Well, except for that and like a dozen other companies that have gone bankrupt. But I mean, you know, if you look at the way they dressed him, there's nothing, you wouldn't be able to pinpoint when that thing came from.
They did some very smart things with the design.
Truly. If you look at, I'll give you this example. If you look at Taxi Driver, next time you watch Taxi Driver.
Which is every Christmas.
Right. Everybody in that film looks like they're in 1975, 76. Everyone.
Oh, yeah.
Except for Travis Bickle. De Niro looks like it could be, you don't know what fucking year it is with him. The way the jeans that he's wearing, they're not flares. The haircut, the jacket, like he seems to be a man out of time. Like you don't know what time frame it is for him. Oh. That's kind of it for Blade Runner, I think. I don't know why I'm talking about Blade Runner now, but you get it. Do you remember your first encounter with Star-Lord? Do you remember your first?
I want to say it's probably the issue 7.
Wow.
With the is it issue 7? I could be wrong. With the X-wing and the TIE fighter.
Okay. I have it somewhere, but I didn't get it when it came out.
I'm pretty sure it was very early. Like I don't think I got every issue.
Okay.
Up until like, you know, as a kid, I would beg, but I seem to very well remember that issue. So, and then I was fascinated with Star-Lord because it would tell me about model animation or matte paintings, or because I dreamed of doing that stuff as a kid. And, you know, I lived in a very kind of semi-rural area. There was no comic book stores, nothing cool. You know, it was strip malls and the biggest comic book store in five towns was a place called Morgan Self, which was a used bookstore. And on the other side were some old comics, you know, Gold Key and. Okay. That was it. That was absolutely it. So Star-Lord was like this magazine literally from another planet for me.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
And you know, and the fact that it would cover anything like, it, you know, because we live in an embarrassment of riches now.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, like if you were a fan of science fiction, well, buddy boy, you better like Land of the Giants because that may be the only sci-fi show on all week, you know, and
you're right.
So they would talk about, you know, Land of the Giants. They would talk about moldy old 50s, you know, first spaceship on Venus type movies.
Right. They didn't
leave anything out of the conversation. They would talk about Saturday morning cartoons.
It was like having a conversation with Bob Burns every month.
Every month,
who by the way would turn up in the magazine. Like every other month, Bob Burns was doing something in that magazine.
Yeah, I always wondered who the hell he was, like as a kid.
I've met him a couple of times. There used to be a place which has since reopened in a different spot in Burbank called Creature Features. And it used to be on Olive. So on my, you know, like Saturdays, I would hit the comic shop called House of Secrets up on Olive. Right across from the Safari Inn Motel, which was in True Romance.
Okay.
House of Secrets is still there. Creature Features shut down for quite a while and moved somewhere else. But it was this cool little monster shop. And, you know, on a Saturday, he'd be up there just holding court, talking to people. And we talked about Flash Gordon one time. He was a super nice guy. But I never knew what he did other than, you know, show up in Star-Lord. but let's talk about that real quick. So you just said – in regards to shows, you know, if you were waiting for the next, you know, new series to pop up, like, you know, Fantastic Journey, you better enjoy
all 10 episodes before they cancel it and put on some.
You better enjoy Lost in Space.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's all you were going to get. Conversely, or similarly, with Star-Lord, if it wasn't in the shops, you found something else. Now, two things happened. One, again, back to my cousin David, who, you know, found a lot of this stuff before I did. He was a big Starlog guy, but he was a couple years older than me and still is, if he's alive. But he jumped over.
Speaking to Cousin David these days?
No, not for close to 20 years.
Wow.
He jumped over to Fangoria pretty quickly. Now, I remember Fangoria because he knew how much I loved Doctor Who. And issue number 2 of Fangoria, we've talked about this.
Oh, yeah.
One of the very first things, you know, merchandise-wise, I'd say I could ever find on Doctor Who. Issue 2 of Fangoria had Prophecy on the cover. That was the creature for that movie, Prophecy. The creature was on the cover. But there was a special, which is so weird when you think about it now, Fangoria, not Starlog, Fangoria did a special article on the monsters of Doctor Who with a pullout poster. And it was that great poster of Tom Baker, you know, holding his hat off of his head, like kind of smiling, and then like Target artwork from the Target books of creatures around him and the logo. That was on my wall when I was a kid. Like, wow, a Doctor Who poster. But Fangoria was, I think, the issue that I think I either borrowed it from him or I bought it was, that, do you remember that movie Zombie? That Italian?
Fulci. I love that movie.
Fulci. But do you remember the classic image?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. That gave my mother a heart attack.
The We Are Going to Eat You Zombie, like the VHS box. Yeah, yeah.
Fangoria was very, very graphic. And
that's, I never read it because of that.
Yeah, me either. Like, I liked, you know, scary movies and horror movies, but not on that level. Not the Friday the 13th. So I never was into that stuff. So Fangoria was there every now and then if you couldn't find Starlog. But there was a slew of other magazines that sort of popped up in Starlog's wake. Now, I made a little list, but you're probably going to be better at this. Because I may be wrong about some of these titles. There was a magazine called Future. Was that one?
I don't remember Future. I remember I remember one called Laser Blast that looked like it was thrown together by like a 12-year-old, you know.
Yeah, that kind of I remember Starburst. Do you remember Starburst?
Okay, wasn't that the UK kind of equivalent of Starlog?
Yes.
Yeah. It was that was actually pretty decent. There was Fantastic Films.
Don't remember. I remember Fantastic Films. I do remember that.
Yeah.
I might have picked that up a few times. The one I remember that I picked up the most was Fantasy Empire. Now, you know this because it was, again, on that newspaper type print.
Fantasy Empire.
Okay. I think we talked about this before. They covered a lot of British stuff.
Oh.
But they loved Doctor Who. They loved the Avengers.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I have a couple issues of that as well somewhere.
Yeah, they did. They famously did a sit-down interview with all of the Pythons except for Michael.
Well, isn't Fantasy Empire just Empire magazine now?
No.
No, I always thought those were.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
that's funny. Nope, no, it was totally, totally different. But they used to, you know, they used to do like episode guides of Sapphire and Steel.
Oh yeah, Tomorrow People and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
That no one's ever really thought about. Yeah.
No. Which kind of always blew my mind because even today, you'd look at an issue from 83 with an episode guide for for Sapphire and Steel, and like, I don't remember that show ever being on like public television. Do you remember ever seeing that show on television? Like just as it aired or like in syndication?
The only time I ever remember seeing it on television was in a con suite, and
what?
I remember like, you know, the con suite.
Oh, okay, got it.
It's going up to someone and going, what is this? You know?
I still don't know what the hell that show was about.
It was pretty good. I remember enjoying it, but I've never revisited it. Great actors.
Yes, great. And a trippy, trippy, strange premise. I just couldn't tell you what the hell the show was about. Every now and then, okay, so there were, and also there was Preview magazine. Do you remember Preview?
Yeah.
Which was created by Jim Steranko.
Yeah, right? And it was of interest to.
Oh right.
Yeah.
Yes, it had. They were big fans of Sybil Danning.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
They were big Danning fans. But that was a pretty good.
There really wasn't a lot of good reading in previews, as I recall.
Well, no, there was a lot of behind the scenes stuff, and every now and then preview would do like a giveaway, like they would do an insert that was like blueprints from a movie, or the most famous one that I love and actually had framed. Starenko famously, we might have talked about this at some point, forgive me if we have. Starenko famously was the guy that Spielberg and Lucas got in touch with and said, we're doing this new thing, this character called Indiana Jones. Here's what we want him to look like, a cross between, you know, Bogart and Treasure, the physical appearance, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, a little bit of Charlton Heston in The Greatest Show on Earth or whatever that was. And Starenko did a set of paintings, one of which was used famously as the cover of the Kenner board game. There were two different board games for Indiana Jones for Raiders.
I remember that, yeah.
The Kenner board game, the yellow cover, they used Starenko's artwork. So it's Indy in the foreground on the right side and a bunch of, you know, German trucks in the desert. Then there's one where he's jumping. I think there's one where he's fighting the mechanic in front of the plane. There's one where he's like in, you know, ended up, you know, looking like the Well of the Souls. But this is where it started to come together. John Landis's wife, Deborah, I'm going to get her name wrong, Noodleman and Nadoodleman or whatever, has always claimed that she came up with the costume. I think it was Starenko. I think those guys had ideas. Starenko put the designs together, and then she put the costume together. But, you know, the leather jacket, the fedora, the whip, it was all there verbally, and then Starenko made it happen. So that he did this pullout before Raiders came out. So it was 1980, this amazing color pullout of all that artwork. And then when you unfolded the whole thing, it was a mini poster with, you know, there wasn't a logo at that point for Raiders. So he sort of made one up for the name of the film. And it's that great shot of him in the desert, which, nerdy trivia, the cover of the board game, they airbrushed out the cigarette that was hanging out of Indiana Jones's mouth for the board game. But anyway, Starenko, I don't know how that happened or why, but he launched a frickin' movie magazine about, you know, and it was really thick. It was loaded with articles. The other thing about Starlog, of all these titles that we're talking about, except for Fangoria, not even Famous Monsters, I think the Fangoria and Starlog, I think, are the only two that ever had color pages.
That was it. Yeah, Famous Monsters didn't, and that was another thing. They would have a mixture of black and white and then glossy color pages. That's right.
Yeah, and they would sometimes, Starlog would do things like, you know, an issue that you had pull out Star Trek blueprints.
Or even in the 79 was it 80, the number 36 that we're talking about, the fourth anniversary issue, they mm-hmm. show Mego toys, like all the new sci-fi toys.
Yeah, I was going to tell you that because I flipped through it before before I called you. Oh, and I got to go over some of the...
And you know, do you remember they used to also print those offshoot books? Like
yes!
They did toy collecting. And
you know who wrote that one?
Who wrote that one?
Steve Sansweet.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. I think I used to know that. But
I've got that somewhere.
I do too. And you know, that was very – that left an imprint on me because I was like,
oh, yeah.
Adults collect old toys. You
right.
know? And
that's right.
But they did ones on weapons, and I used to pick these up whenever I could. Sci-fi weaponry, robots, you know.
The space toy one I love because, again – and this goes back to just what we're even talking about here. That was it for us. Those were our guidebooks. Besides like the Sears catalog to look at toys, that was the only reference guide we had, was a book like that or Starlog. So I'm looking at the page here, the games people play, science fiction games people play. So this is like the you know, it's the fourth anniversary issue, but this is sort of a toy preview page.
Yeah.
So it's a color page, and I've got here something called TSR Hobbies does something called Snitz Revenge. The TSR were famously the ones that did Dungeons and Dragons and board and games like that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We've got Entex, Battle of the Planets G1 spaceship model.
Yep.
From the Mego science fiction line, a Micronaut, a 12-inch Klingon figure from Star Trek The Motion Picture.
That's a prototype.
Buck Rogers Land Rover, a Micronaut vehicle.
That never got released in the United
States.
What
the hell is
this? That's Lobstros.
What is it?
Lobstros.
Because it looks like a lobster.
I'm standing about 3 feet away from mine because it did get sold in Canada.
It did?
Yes.
Bastard.
Canada and Italy had to pay up front for their stuff. So if Mego canceled the line, we still got stuck with it.
Because you can't trust the Italians.
Or the Canadians.
A Micronaut vehicle, 12-inch Tiger Man figure, and yep. a starfighter from Buck Rogers.
This by the way, Buck. Looks exactly like my Christmas wish list that year.
Right? Mr. Spock and Lieutenant Ilia figures from Star Trek The Motion Picture Collection. NPCs, hobby kits of the Black Hole robots, Maximilian and Vincent, and Entex Space Shuttle Orbiter. Guess which one of those toys nobody gave a shit about? The Space Shuttle Orbiter.
Yeah, I would.
But it's funny, the Buck Rogers little vehicle that they show is that Land Rover thing.
That's great. I love that toy.
Yeah, because that's uber rare, right? So that's
fun. I don't know if it's uber rare.
Here's some of the tributes. I'll just name some people for you. Bob Burns, of course, who under each name as a tribute, under each name they would sort of say who they were, what their you know claim to fame. But for someone like William Shatner, we didn't need a descriptive you know sentence what his job was. But his says it says actor Star Trek King. Here's what it has listed.
Kingdom of the Spiders.
Actor, Star Trek, Kingdom of the Spiders, Big Bad Mama.
Well, this was before IMDb.
It's true. Shatner's tribute says, happy birthday from a fan. Here's Forey Ackerman, whose description, literary agent, editor of Famous Monsters of Filmland, curator of SF Museum. He writes, Starlog, 5 years agog, sci-fi, a natural high. You can always count on Forey for a rhyme, right?
He was the original rap artist.
A shitty rhyme. We got Gene Roddenberry. We've got who else do we have here?
Xenia Merton.
We've got Wade Williams III.
He owns Planet Nine from Outer Space.
Wade Williams?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
We got Leonard Nimoy. He wrote, Starlog is to science fiction what Beethoven was to music.
I love the fact that half the cast of Space 1999 has written in 3 years after Space 1999 has left the air.
Well, you know what I love is you've got people like Leonard Nimoy and Shatner and Roddenberry next to Bijo Trimble.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. And then, but you got these people like Nimoy writes, you know, one little sentence. Then you got Dave Prowse, who wrote a novel.
Yeah. Well, Nick Tate, right next to him, wrote a big long novel. Nick Tate was
wrote a huge
Alan
thing.
Carter there.
Arthur C. Clarke. He writes, sorry, I absolutely refuse to believe that Starlog is the most popular science fiction magazine in the universe. But happy birthday anyway. See, what he's trying to say is there's more life out there in the universe. Than we think. Harryhausen, let's see, Lou Scheimer and Norm Prescott, awesome.
Big fan.
Rick Baker, awesome. The brothers Hildebrandt, Buster Crabbe, Bijo Trimble, who I mentioned. Just a smattering of who turned out for the anniversary issue. Now this issue 42, this was a fun one as well. So it's got Mark Leonard on the front, Star Trek's other alien. It's got not only does it have, and this is, sometimes there's such a thing as, you know, don't bother with an article if it's not, like, do we really need to write this article? So first of all, what was cool about this issue was it came with you know how they used to do flexi discs in music magazines?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I had this issue. Yeah, I remember doing that.
It came with a flexi disc, and I lent it to someone.
You had to put a quarter on it, right?
Yes, in the middle. I lent it to someone to burn onto CD for me because because I don't have a turntable. But in this issue, what's so great about it is it's got this fantastic article about the Filmation
animated Flash Gordon.
Flash Gordon and the TV movie. Now, the TV movie didn't air until 1982. The animated series was 79. This issue is 1980. And it's talking about the problems that this animated, you know, feature was having. But it's got images that this image of animated Hitler on this video monitor, which is just
It took me years to see that finally.
Yeah, it's never been released on DVD. It did not get released with the rest of the.
I caught it one summer, like they played it like on a Saturday in the summer.
Yeah, I've got my copies from Alex. He got it burned from. It's a pretty good burn. But this article goes into great detail about how Dino De Laurentiis helped finance the animated feature, the 2-hour feature, because and how much of the designs he borrowed. He kind of said to Filmation, "Hey, I'll give you some bread to finish this thing, but can you share some of the designs and some of the plans you have? Because I'm actually probably said it more like." Hey, I'll give you some of the money.
That's better, yeah.
For the film, but I already did the film with the bigger monkey.
So the record that this came with, that had the Avengers theme on it, right?
Well, yes, it had the Twilight Zone theme. It was all done by the way, famously, it was done by Neil Norman's Cosmic Orchestra.
I'm just looking at them. It's very brave of them to be glam in 1981.
Right, he does all these covers, but there were some great it's all you could, it's all you had. If you couldn't find, you, and if you couldn't hear it on TV, this is all you had.
I want to point out too is what a sense of looking backward we had. Like now, it's all about what's next, and you wouldn't find as many articles about like
that's true
TV shows that were off the air 20 years ago.
That's true. But let's because we really have to get to the most exciting section of the magazine in just a moment. But just to tell you that how much stuff got covered in this magazine. The article before the article on Neil Norman's Cosmic Orchestra, the article is titled "The Thinking Cap" or "Where Can I Get a Patch Like That?" And it's about a ball cap company because it was all the rage right around this time that people wanted the same, you know, ball cap with the mesh, you know, the cloth front and the mesh, plastic mesh back half that were mostly used as crew caps. People wanted them for themselves. So here's this article on this company called The Thinking Cap, I think. The Thinking Cap Company. Oh, look, Pico Boulevard, L.A. I wonder if they're still around.
They aren't.
And it's all, but the patches that they show.
I want the Harlan Ellison hat.
The Harlan Ellison. Harlan Ellison is wearing a trucker cap with a patch on the front that says Harlan Ellison. What a D-bag.
What a founder of the hipster movement.
What a D-bag.
But I need that hat.
So here's where it gets fun. The thing that I certainly glommed onto fairly quickly with Starlog was the classified section.
Oh, that's how I started collecting toys.
When you got toward the back of the magazine, there was an amazing classified section.
And I could probably name some of the people without even looking at it.
Uh-huh.
There would be that guy in England. Sorry, I can't be a little more descriptive.
No, I think this is the one. Remember I was
John or something like that?
It says Best of British.
Yes. And then there's comics by Rogowski.
Doctor Who, Prisoner, 1999 Horror, UFO, and much more. Send $1 US or 30p UK for our catalog to James. Yep. 17 Bifurcate. Now, if this is the guy that I'm thinking of, this is who I told you about in our Doctor Who episode, that he would send this catalog. It was photocopied and folded. By the time it got to little old me in the Twin Cities, this thing was so beat up and so worn that it was hard. The type was so tiny you could barely read some of these entries.
Those things gave you goosebumps when you got to you.
Just
yes.
these little lists. These sometimes they would be on blue paper or
yes.
you know, and they'd just be typewritten, and you would just get like, oh, you know.
Yeah.
There was the guys I used to deal with called the Back Issue, and I met them out of Starlog. They were guys, uh-huh. Hank Hell, and they used to have a more professional catalog, but it was just, you know, white paper type, and
right.
it would just say, you know, British Captain Koenig doll mint on card $70, and you would just go, I gotta have that, you
right.
know. But the Rogowski guy was in every issue. I just found
Rogowski was well. Let's go back to the British thing. The
yeah.
thing that was crazy about that. I might have mentioned this to you before. My family had a restaurant, an Italian restaurant. My great grandmother started it. Then my grandmother. Then you know, with my great uncles. Then my dad, and myself, and my two older brothers, Jack and Gino. We all and my cousin Dave. We all worked there. So I was working there, bussing tables. Probably when it wasn't even legal to do so. When I was like, you know, 11 or 12 years old,
yeah,
I was a busboy on a Friday or Saturday night. The waitresses would share tips now and then, but I would get tips as well. So I always had cash. I was that kid, and all through high school too, because I waited tables for 7 years. I always had cash. And what was cool about this, if this is the one I'm thinking of, this British thing, and this is so insane when you think about it, if you sent him U.S. cash, you got like a 30% discount. Okay, I don't know why or how that worked. So I would send him cash, and I was so dumb. I could have just, you know, if it was like, you know, 78 cents or 75 cents, I should have just sent him another dollar.
Yeah.
But instead, I would tape coins to an index card, a cardboard index card, wrap the cash up in another envelope, put it in this envelope with my order list, and put extra postage on. I never, ever lost an envelope. I always got my stuff. And I sent cash across the pond to this guy. So I think that's the guy. And I got the bulk of my Doctor Who stuff I got from this guy. But what was the guy you said? Rogowski?
Rogowski. Howard Rogowski, I think, was his name. And he always had that ad
that
just said comics. I bet you he's still around.
I remember the one that was called – it said Still Things is Still the Best.
Oh, just
giant catalog of SF photos, audio tapes, scripts, slides, glamour. Send $2 to Still Thing. Oh, and that's another thing. SASE. What's it stand for?
Self-addressed envelope.
Self-addressed stamped envelope.
Yeah.
That was it. You'd wrap up another envelope with a stamp on it.
I really do have these. I would never show anybody, but I do have from like 86 and 87. Daytimers that my parents would give me, and I you know, like calendars, and
Ooh.
And I would write money order for Romulan doll sent, and I would put an R in the calendar. That's the way I spoke in 1987.
Right.
And
but that only changed a couple years ago.
Yeah, that's right. I finally had that change. I would put an R in every day of the week. Until it arrived, and then I don't know why, although
no.
I'm fascinated by it now.
Listen,
but it would take like 3 months to get something.
Right. People don't understand what it was like mailing away for something. Not only when I mailed away, like I said, the cash, if I mailed away to get something from the UK, not only did my envelope take like a week and a half to get to them, by the time the merchandise got to me, it was like 6 or 8 weeks to get this stuff. That is an eternity. And the bus would drop me off at the corner, and I would walk down the sidewalk because our house was in the middle of the street. Not in the middle of the street for cars to drive around, but in the middle of the block. And when I got about 6 houses from our house, because we had a hill – you could walk up the front steps, like where the hill was, and then where the front door was, there was a regular mailbox and then a big plastic orange one where the newspaper would go in. That's where packages went, or just on the step. Man, I could see if there was a package from about 5 houses away from our house, and the pace would quicken. My breathing changed, like, and instead of going in the house, going up the driveway in the back, through the house, open the front door, grab the package, I would run up the front steps
just to not waste any more time, to get this thing in my hands and then walk around to the back door and go inside the house. So Starlog was it. I mean, that's where you went to try to find this stuff. So let me just give a couple more here. So Still Things is still the best. The couple I was hoping it would be in here that I can.
Well, I've got 82 here, and there's some choice ones in here.
We've talked about this company before, and I swear that I learned about them through Starlog, which was Intergalactic Trading Company.
Oh yeah, they definitely used to have ads. Right? I remember their logo and
the dragon, and they still exist on eBay. You can go on eBay and look them up. The logo is still the same.
By the way, somebody wrote to us, and forgive me that I can't remember your name. During one of our episodes, and I was talking about how I went in there and bought Golden Throats on my honeymoon. Uh-huh. And somebody, I think I even know this person, wrote and said I was probably the manager when you were in there. Yeah. I thought that was hilarious. Yeah.
That's brilliant. Well, didn't somebody post some pictures or send us photographs of
The store. Yeah, that could be. I used to deal with a guy on here by the name he used to go by the handle of Star Tech.
Okay.
And I used to trade videos with him, and he was really a nice guy. He had an obsession with getting, I think, everything on TV, and he was obsessed with a Canadian program called Star Lost.
That was Kier Dulay, right?
Yeah. And
There's no reason I should know that.
Well, I think you know, and I know that we know more than we need to know about some of this stuff. He would give me 3-1 on Star Losts because he was so obsessed with getting every episode.
Okay.
And so I was like rolling in. Every month tapes would come in from this guy, like Logan's Run and UFO and Fantastic Journeys and just things that, you know, obscure television. Because, like I said, when you were a sci-fi fan in the 80s and 70s, you had to look backward because there wasn't a lot of looking forward.
Right.
You know who really does a good job of parodying that is Evan Dorkin. He has a comic called The Eltingville Club.
Okay.
And it's about a bunch of teenage nerds. But they are very much not teenage nerds of this ilk. You know, they know they know who Diana Rigg is and Honor Blackman. They know who Twiki is. You know, there's this right. – it's definitely kind of a poke at sci-fi nerds of our generation.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
He did a Cartoon Network pilot as well.
With that. And it's definitely rooted. I think they have a trivia off that's just basically like 70s and 80s sci-fi trivia in that.
Well, episode. Intergalactic was one. There was a place called New Eye Studio.
I remember New Eye Studios. Yep.
New Eye Studios. And then there was one, and this was an odd one because I didn't really understand what licensed merchandise meant versus, you know,
bootleg.
But I understand now. I understand who these people were. They made bumper stickers.
TK Graphics, was that their name?
Holy shit!
Yeah, I still probably have some of their stuff.
Was that it? TK Graphics?
I seem to remember that.
They would make it like, you know, a sign that said, you know, the answer is 42 or whatever.
Yeah, they had all these, and they were just obviously a very simple printing press somewhere.
Right, but for me that was like almost like an official piece of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy merchandise.
Yeah.
But instead it was, but if you ordered a certain amount, they also did stuff like, you know, a sign that would say like unicorn crossing.
Yeah, I have a drawing of two Daleks looking at a spaceship with a staircase.
Right.
And it says, "There goes our plans for universal domination," which right. I thought was really funny in 1983. But
right. So, but if you ordered a certain amount of merchandise, you got like a 20% discount. So I was sure to, like, you know, oh, I guess I'm only at $2 away. I might as well order that cardboard sign that says, you know, the answer is 42, whatever.
Meanwhile, if, you know, if you just had some access to a photocopier and some label paper.
Wait a second. What was it called? TK?
I thought it was TK Graphics, and I think it stood for the two people's names. I remember there was like a caricature of like a woman and a guy that looked kind of hippie-ish on the envelopes.
Now here's a weird one. This is 1980. Okay, remember? So you had different sections in the classifieds. You had catalogs. You had clubs and organizations. You'll love this. The only club listed is UFO Report.
Oh yeah.
From Winnipeg. Now, I don't know if that meant the series or if that meant...
Oh, that actually probably meant, you know, the Watch the Skies people.
Watch the Skies?
But, you know, they used to kill me because you would, again, in Starlog, 1981, you'd read Space 1999 Fan Club, you know, you'd think, what do you guys talk about?
Right, hoping the show will come back. But this is an interesting bit. In the merchandise column, there is a picture. This is so... random and bizarre. There is a little black and white picture of Woody Allen from Sleeper.
Yeah, the Sleeper shirt.
As the robot. And it says time travel in a Sleeper t-shirt. White or tan. Sizes $6.75 to Starglow in LA. Send 25 cents for catalog. Great Christmas gifts that get you there. Who was pining for a t-shirt of Woody Allen as the robot in Sleeper? Time travel in a Sleeper t-shirt. How random is that?
It is weird.
And there's one of these, and I don't remember which one it was that I used to get the catalog, and it was all model kits, but they had a ton of Japanese stuff.
I used to order kits from them. I got Godzilla and Ultraman kits from them.
Do you remember the figural ones that were figural Captain Scarlet kits?
Yeah, the little tiny Japanese ones. They look like a pain in the butt to paint. I had those too.
I thought they were...
Did Mia do those? I can't remember.
I got some of those, and I thought, for me, that was like, these are action figures for Captain Scarlet.
Pretty much were.
Right?
Yeah.
But they were kind of...
Now, did you keep up with Starlog throughout the 80s? Because I kind of did, off and on.
Oh, I did.
You could always pick it up, but then...
Yeah. I tapered off.
What's that?
Sorry. I tapered off, and then I think I started to get it again, that famous... summer of 89. I used to pick it up every single month, but by that point I was kind of dipping back into, you know, sci-fi and genre stuff. And the famous summer of 89, which was Batman, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2. So I kind of dipped back in by that famous summer of 89, which was Batman, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, and for me, James Bond, License to Kill, one of the best Bond films ever done.
It was a good geek summer, and
yeah,
I remember buying the Starlog was the first or Comic Scene, which I was very fond of too.
Mm-hmm.
Had that great first image of Michael Keaton boosting up Jack Nicholson as the Joker.
Right.
And I remember thinking, oh wow, you know, now I kind of faltered on Starlog. I still liked it, but in the 1990s for me, you know, first of all, I got kind of into this post-punk thing where I was reading Psychotronic magazine and fanzines. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I was more into that sort of thing. And the onset of all the Star Trek property, which was a gold mine for Starlog, you know, like New Generation and DS9 and all that, it just it didn't interest me. So Starlog became a little too Star Trek-y for me in the 90s.
Yes, I definitely – it was just kind of here or there. But also, I found that the articles were – I found that – like many magazines that existed when Star Wars hit, who all kind of jumped on the bandwagon for sci-fi stuff, by the time you got to the early 90s, Starlog was becoming – I mean, again, not that we're talking about, you know, the height of you know, high-profile, you know, magazine. But what was happening was they were doing like they were really – widening the umbrella where you would have an interview. Not that there's anything wrong with this, because I love Monty Python and the Python guys. Like, they interviewed John Cleese, and they interviewed him for no other reason than Kim Howard Johnson was a contributor to the magazine, and he had, because he was a Python crony, he had immediate access to John Cleese. But the crux of the article was, is Monty Python sci-fi? Here's what we discovered. And it was kind of like, I mean, I remember one, the cover of Starlog started to get ridiculously busy with the amount of things that were listed on either side of the photograph, where you could barely make out who was on the cover. And there was one, I forget what the cover was, but I'll never forget this. You know how they would, if they would say like William Shatner, and then there'd be a, you know, dot, dot, you know, William Shatner, Star Trek ruined my life, you know, was the quote. Or you knew that there was an article slash interview with Shatner in the magazine, and he said that that's the tag they put on the cover. This one, I forget who was on the cover, but the little thing on the side, it said, Veronica Cartwright, quote, I was raped by the alien.
Oh, brother.
And somewhere in the interview, she says, well, you know, it's kind of implied if you look at that footage again, it looks like the alien has done something to me before it kills me. Spoilers, if anyone hasn't seen Alien.
Well, I'll just strike it from my Netflix queue.
Veronica Cartwright doesn't do so well in that film. And I don't remember if she even said it, but the fact that that was the quote on the cover, like, I was raped by the alien. Like, what's going on, Starlog? So,
The thing that I remember really, and this was, you know, my angry smoking cigarettes days, but I remember picking up an issue, and they were interviewing a genre veteran, like a guy who had been in hundreds of films and television shows.
Right.
And hundreds of genre films and television shows, horror, sci-fi. And the guy was talking clearly about his career, and, you know, I was expecting more of a retrospective that I would get out of, like, say, an issue of Shock Cinema or,
right,
you know, the Film Facts. I was into Film Facts at the time.
Right.
And they just kept going back to Star Trek because the guy was in one episode of Star Trek.
Right.
And I would go and you could tell there was nothing to be gleaned. This guy went to work for 2 days on the set, and they're going, what was William Shatner like?
And it's, and what, like, did you think the character, did you think it was, you know, going to go further in this? Like, the guy, they would get the guy who was going to get married to the girl that Spock wanted to marry in A Muck Time.
Yeah, who had, like, no lines.
Who had not, he didn't say a word, and they would give him 6 pages, you know, an interview in this thing. Yeah, that was happening all the time. The other thing that was happening was a little magazine called Cine Fantastique, which had been around for a long time. But I started to discover that magazine, and that magazine was epic in the amount of material that it would put in. I'll never forget the Batman issue, the Tim Burton Batman issue. That was the cover, and that was the there was a huge article on Batman, but the bulk of the magazine was a Tim Burton retrospective. This is 1989. This is his, what, third movie?
Yeah.
And it's a retrospective of everything, including the freaky deaky Hansel and Gretel thing that he did, which was two Japanese kids. And it was all done in Japanese that nobody saw. It was done for the Disney Channel in 86 or 84 or something. But, I mean, that's how detailed Cine Fantastique would get in 1989.
Do you know who owns Cinema Fantastique now?
I'm sorry?
Do you know who owns Cinema Fantastique now?
Is it Altman?
No, that's our buddy Joe Senna.
He owns Cine Fantastique?
I think so.
No kidding.
I thought so.
I didn't know it was still going.
Yeah, it is. I think he does. Now I feel bad, and I might cut this out.
Sorry, Joe, but we are thinking of you.
Yeah, I think he does.
That's proof that we're thinking of him, right?
Yes, absolutely.
We should probably wind this up some point tonight. But yes. I don't know where
we're
at.
I really wanted to talk a little bit about one thing that's going to be on Plaid Stallions this month is a retrospective. I saw some photos of the Japanese Starlog store. There were two of them. And I have some photos. I found them in a Japanese issue of Starlog I had kicking around.
Right.
But you were unaware of this, but there were Starlog stores, and I don't know how long they were around.
I did not know this.
When I was in college, I would save up every penny I had, get in a car with four people. Sometimes you didn't know everybody in the car, and that was some
you know, sleep in the diviest hotels in the world.
Right.
But the first or second time my friends and I went, we found the Starlog store at a mall in New Jersey. Now, there's a million malls in New Jersey, but, you know, we found this store, and it was unbelievable because, one, I had been driving 12 hours. Like, we'd literally gotten up at, like, 6 in the morning, and we were there at 6 at night walking around this mall. Mm-hmm. And me and my friends went in the Starlog store, and you ever have that, like, oh, my God, I am so tired, I can't think?
You know? Yeah, it's happening right now.
Thank you. I remember walking in front of a glass display case, and there were Japanese Star Wars figures in there. There were Migos. There was all this incredible eye candy, a little pricey, and I certainly couldn't afford any of it. But for some reason, the clerk in the Starlog store, and I hope he's not listening and I'm insulting him, he decided that's a guy I should try to talk to. And I'm not for he was a big dude, and he was one of those guys who's like, well, I'm an XL, but I'll try this large. So he comes over to me, and I no word of a lie, he talks like this. Hi, welcome to Starlog Store. My name is Kevin. Do you like Star Wars? Oh, you know, Cary O'Quinn's in here. Cary O'Quinn's on my magazine. And I couldn't follow him. I don't know if he was actually speaking normally and I was just tired, but he would not leave me alone. And, you know, he worshipped Cary O'Quinn and automatically assumed that because I walked in the store, I did too.
Right.
And what's that?
As you do.
Yeah. And I don't think – I think it finally broke his gaze and he left me alone was I just basically said, like, I came here in car. Like, I had nothing bright to say whatsoever.
I can breathe.
Yeah. But eventually this is what I wanted to say about this store was I couldn't afford anything. My friend was barely my friend was just interning on movies, my friend Sean. Uh-huh. So we would come back to the Starlog store every year, and I think it was probably like 95 or 96. Sean had just come back from filming The Outer Limits. I was on my first crappy job in the city, you know. And I remember thinking we'd made it because Sean went in and bought Vincent Price's autograph.
Hello.
Off the wall, and I was like, wow. Yeah, we're, you know, I didn't buy anything.
You made it.
We, you know, he was making it, man, you know.
How much was that?
It was probably a couple hundred bucks back then.
So this was so you know of at least two Starlog stores that existed in shopping malls.
Yeah, and the last time I tried a couple years later I tried to go back to it because obviously I was working and I wanted to, you know, buy some of the expensive trinkets behind the wall, and I got lost into what is the scariest neighborhood I have ever been to. And a police car pulled out, and my wife and I followed that police car, she's my girlfriend, for 10 miles until he pulled over to get a donut, and we begged him to tell us how to get back to our hotel.
Wow, a cop pulled over for donuts?
Well, you know, whatever he was getting.
So stereotypical.
But we were actually literally in, like, farm fields when he pulled over. And I was like, I don't care. We're going to follow this cop forever.
Wow. If there had been a Starlog store growing up, I never would have left the shopping mall.
It was really I was jealous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that this existed anywhere. And, of course, it was loaded with, like, movie posters and back issues of Starlog. You know, by this time, I wasn't reading anymore. You know, right. I'd pick up the odd one for my girlfriend at the time because she was like into Hercules and Xena, but nothing else.
You know, it's funny. Well, that's two retail stores now that I wish I would. The other one is the Heroes World.
Oh, yeah. I would
semi obsessed with finding more photographic evidence of such a thing. Because I mean, can you imagine?
Oh, I can't. You know what? I'm jealous of people who tell me they've been there.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, that would have been, oh my God, we never would have left.
No, and I do have some photos of those stores, and it just compounds, like, the, oh, you know.
You found pictures of the Heroes World stores?
Yeah, I found some articles on them that take some pictures. They're not the kind of pic, you know, I want someone to have gone in with a camera and taken a picture of every aisle.
Right.
Which you're never going to get, you know, like 99% of the vintage toy store pictures I have, I'm more interested in what's on the left than what they're taking the photo of. You
right.
know, it's like, here's a whole whack of Hot Wheels and you can see the sides of 50 carded Migos right there. Yeah. Right. You know,
but they, the thing is, like, I wonder if it probably still wouldn't have been quite as glorious as those catalogs. Those catalogs
had everything under the sun, and I can't imagine you got it. And we should do a Heroes World episode one of these days.
I thought, didn't we do one?
No.
Did we do one?
We probably touched on it somewhere.
Oh, okay. I thought we did one. If we haven't, we've got to. Like, those are such a thing of beauty. I have about 7 or 8 of them.
I've got 2 in front of me.
They're so fun to just, you know, look at as you're drifting off to sleep, and you can have, you know, dreams of, you know, sugar plum fairies dancing in your head. And this catalog, like, it's just, it's so beautiful. And it so takes me back to a time. I mean, just like all this stuff, like, that's, you know, Starlog and all the stuff that we're talking about, we're those people. And believe me, there are people out there that don't have this kind of recall. But I'm not saying that we're special because it's about toys. I'm saying there are people out there that don't have this kind of recall when it comes to music, even.
No.
Where, for me, not every single song, but certain songs or albums I'll know exactly where I was when I bought that thing, or the summer that that song was huge, or whatever. Food can do it here or there, but mainly it comes down to music and toys and, you know, things like these. Like, I remember certain issues of Starlog, you know, what the weather was like that day when I bought that. Like, it was a rainy day. And
oh, yeah. Well, like I said, I picked up this 82 issue out of my drawer. I've had this since 1982. Mm-hmm. I can remember it would, you know, they had the next month column. They were doing a thing on Lost in Space. Lost in Space was running in my market at the time. Like, I was hyped up on it. And I was like, I've got to read that issue. I can tell you the store I bought it at. I can remember tell you the circumstance. My parents pulled over to do something.
Right.
And there was a little variety store right next door. And it was a Checkers. I ended up working at Checkers years later.
Checkers.
I went, just hold it. Just wait one second. I ran in and it was there. I swear to God, that store had 3 magazines, and for some reason they had the latest issue of Starlog. And I bought it. I was thrilled, you know? And I still remember that. And it's got Megaforce in it, too.
I remember the market very similar. There was a market. Do you remember the Blade Runner collector's magazine? Remember how they'd put out a collector's magazine for whatever friggin' movie was that came out, and it was
a Marvel comics adaptation. Can I tell you something? And you won't get mad?
If you say you've never seen Blade Runner, I might get mad.
Oh, that's not true, but you still might get mad. I am not a fan.
Of Blade Runner?
Nope.
No, but wait a second. Do you
mean no likey?
But you don't like it at all?
I just don't get it. I get stylistically.
Okay.
Why the film is so copied and enviable, because it is really a trend-setting look.
Sure, but you realize you're not alone. I mean, it's not a movie that set the world on fire then, and it certainly doesn't now. There's loads of people that find it dull as dishwater.
I've tried to watch I've probably seen about 72 of the 108 different cuts there are of the film, and I just don't get it. I don't begrudge people that like it.
You're allowed.
But
what's interesting about this, because this has to do with merchandise, so you may find this little tidbit interesting. There was a market in St. Paul. I know exactly where it was. I can't remember the name of it. But this magazine haunted me. I didn't have the courage to ask my mom to pony up the dough. For some reason, I didn't have cash that week or whatever. But I managed to get her to go back to the market again that week. I made some excuse about needing orange juice or I don't know what, and she waited in the car. I went in, and I still held this magazine in my hand and debated back and forth, should I spend, because it was like, you know, $4.95 maybe, something like that. That was a hefty little penny. But what was most exciting about this collector's special, you know, edition issue of Blade Runner, the special movie magazine, whatever, The back, either the back cover or the back inside cover. No, I take it back. The very back cover was an ad on for the Ertl diecast Blade Runner vehicles.
I remember those, yeah.
And there, and so in this ad, it's they're prototypes. You can tell that they're prototypes. So there's a picture of the spinner in action from the film, and then a paragraph describing these vehicles. Because this was an R-rated movie, I always found it so strange that Ertl decided to make these diecasts. And of course, they came out individually carded, and they came out in a box set, which are now worth a bundle. I mean, I have them, you know, both versions, but they're kind of pricey. But in the inside back cover was an ad. I've told you this before, how obsessed I was with fan clubs.
Yeah, was there a Blade Runner fan club?
There was a Blade Runner fan club. Many years later, in the late 90s, I ended up meeting a guy called Paul Salmon, who wrote a great book called Future Noir, which was the making of Blade Runner. And he's all over the Blade Runner commemorative DVDs that came out, and the huge, you know, the 2-hour documentary about the making of the film. He's the authority, and he believes that it probably never got made, this fan club. Like there weren't enough orders that came in.
You got a card and it said like 003.
Well, I might, you know, think about it. I might have even sent away. I might have had my mother write a check or get a money order to send away for this fan club, and I never got my kit. But the picture is fantastic because it's like, you know, an 8x10 color shot of Harrison Ford, but blueprints of the spinner, the classic vehicle from it, you know, his ID card, just all this fun memorabilia in the fan club kit. And then, of course, what was going to be a 4 times a year Blade Runner, you know, magazine or, you know, newsletter or whatever that never happened. But I remember exactly where I was. I know we're miles away from the Starlog conversation.
Well, but, no, you know what?
But it all has to do with this sense memory that we can go back to this stuff and remember where we were when we got it and what it meant to us.
I want to just close out with an amusing thing I've just found in this one. This is how comprehensive Starlog was. This is a 1982 issue.
Okay.
There's an article about this new movie called The Whiz Kid, and it shows a picture of Scott Baio and Heather Thomas, and Heather Thomas's top is coming off. It's zapped, but they have the original name as The Whiz Kid, and they just like they're covering this like it's serious, like they're telling us who did the special effects and you know who the art director is. And then on the next page, they're talking about, and this is something I'm fascinated with now, is a Madison Square Garden's performance for 26 weeks of Bugs Bunny in Space. Featuring Bugs Bunny, Batman and Robin, and Wonder Woman, the Joker, Riddler, and Penguin. Like, I have the poster for Bugs Bunny Meets the Superheroes on my wall over here that you can't see, so I don't know why I'm pointing. But, you know, like, that's Starlog. Like, they were all over the place with this. And in the back, there's an ad for something called The Ultimate Fantasy in Houston, Texas. June 1982. Live on stage, Shatner, Kelly, Doohan, Koenig, Nichelle Nichols.
I know this ad that you're talking about.
George Takei, Kirstie Alley, Mark Leonard, no Spock, and Kerry O'Quinn.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you get Kerry O'Quinn for that?
I don't know. They must have just lucked out.
Well, I got something better for you. This is in the news section of the issue 41, which has Max von Sydow Ming on the cover, which is fantastic.
That has a beautiful. I think that one had. No, maybe I'm wrong. Sorry, I'll shut up.
What? No, what?
I was gonna say I'm wrong. It's not that issue.
Well, I'm going to tell you a couple things. One thing that I need you to find for me, because I have searched for this and have yet to find it. You can count on one hand the amount of merchandise that was made for the Close Encounters of the Third Kind film.
Yeah.
On page 8 in this issue of Starlog.
The Mothership model page.
Mothership!
Yeah.
Does this exist?
I don't know. I'm not a big fan of that film, so I don't know.
Oh my God, it's a paperweight. It's like a white metal weight of the Devil's Tower and the Mothership hovering above it. Three types available: deluxe gold tone, electroplated, battery lit. comes with a lighting stand and more than 60 fiber optic lights together with 24 micro tubing booms for detailed lighting. Holy crap! Silvertone, unlit, electroplated with antique devil's tower, and then
It's pricey for that time, even.
$50, but I would kill to get this thing now because they never made this as a model kit or anything. I'd love to get this. We got to put a screen grab up when the episode goes up.
Yeah.
Handle that. But this, you got to
get right
this,
on that.
This is in the news section. Ready?
Yeah.
Hamill, because we talked about Harlan Ellison earlier. Hamill and Ellison friends again. It looks like the war is over. Rapier wit and light satire and lightsaber have been reholstered, and the combatants have agreed to let the past go. Yada, yada. Here's Hamill's quote. I don't want to get on a panel with Harlan Ellison. I saw him on a talk show in Canada, and I thought he was like a game show host. He's like the Don Rickles of science fiction. That's Hamill in Starlog number 21.
What a bloody coup that was.
And Ellison says, since Mark Hamill is, by his own admission, one who does not read books, I take it as a gesture of magnanimity not to further ridicule him. As a functional illiterate, Mr. Hamill does a good enough job on himself. But after the premiere of The Empire Strikes Back, Hamill received a long-distance message, the telephone call of the century. It was from Ellison, he says. I called him back, and we're friends again. It bugged me before because he was making so much money off a group of people he seemed to despise. He called the Star Trek convention goers, quote, terminal acne cases.
I don't think he'd say something.
Hamill says, I don't think they're the most normal people in the world either, but I never want to see them exploited. Because Ellison's introduction to the pinnacle Doctor Who paperbacks is the smuggest, smarmiest asshole type intro. Because in typical Ellison fashion, if it's popular, he hates it. And he trashes Star Wars, Star Trek, you name it. If it's not Doctor Who, it's not worth your time. He called Star Trek bat guano or something, like the worst stuff on television. Of course, he's still pissed off that the budget of the show for City on the Edge of Forever, they couldn't make the effects the way he saw them in his brain or in the script, which was beyond elaborate for these things.
Oh, you know, right next to that Harlan Ellison and Hamill thing is a the Doctor Who Marvel
yes.
comics. I remember that. That's where I found out about that, and I had to run around looking for that.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness.
Yep, and there's a great little sidebar in the Flash Gordon article about, it says Flash Gordon's legal hassles. It goes on about, if anybody's been wondering all these years why Sam Jones' real voice is only in about 20% of the film, that little sidebar may tell you why. Oh, Starlog, we miss you. But the good news is, the way to wrap this up, is this article hit a while ago with the relaunch of Fangoria as a physical magazine. Same people doing that say that Starlog will be hitting the shelves again before the end of the year. But that article came out about 6-8 months ago, and the end of the year is right around the corner. So I don't know. But apparently Starlog is coming back in magazine form.
A digital magazine form, I think.
Oh, it's not physical like the Fangoria?
I didn't read physical. I heard digital, which, you know, it's still nice to see it back. And
yeah. I wonder if they did Harry O'Quinn.
I wonder. I guess they went under, what, 2008, 2009? They fought the good fight. They lasted a long time. You know?
You're right. It wasn't too long ago. They had a really good run.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, so you're right. I'm glad it's coming back in some form. So yeah. There you go. That's a long episode. How many days was that?
It was 4.5, yeah.
Holy crap.
Yeah, actually, you know, between your dog barking and my dog whining, it's probably going to come down to about 57 minutes. I don't know if you noticed that my dog came in and started whining.
No.
Oh.
Not a bit of it.
I better go check that out.
All right, go check that out. There could be a mess you got to clean up.
Thanks, everybody, and you know, visit us on the Facebook page. Tell us some of your Starlog memories.
Yeah, why don't you do that, people?
They've been pretty good to do that. So
That's true, but do more of it.
Do more.
And we, again, we've said it before, but we love suggestions for topics. You know, eventually we're going to run out of ideas.
Well, we clearly are bankrupt as we speak.
We're just not that creative. So please.
The next episode will be Jason and Brian talk about old girlfriends.
Right. Or we'll be going back and going, how about we do one on Doctor Who? We did that already.
Well, no, what we could do is talk about our Doctor Who episode.
There you go.
Oh, that's a good one.
Like a compilation.
How young we were.
Like a sitcom compilation episode, looking back.
We're just kids.
Or the Gary Coleman episodes of Buck Rogers.
Oh, those are excellent.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye.